Good afternoon. It's 3 o'clock and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on Wednesday, the 1st of August, the year 2012. Jeff Brown with you here on a Juneau afternoon. Today we'll talk with Ariel Rolf about the upcoming public art display, Fecal Matters. Darren Snyder will be here with news about this month's sustainability camp. We'll talk to artists involved in Water States opening Friday at the Franklin Street Gallery. And Dana White and James Marcus will be here to highlight tonight's workshop on knotweed. At Writer's Almanac Music and more today on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies, patchy fog later on, chance of rain later on, low temperatures 47 to 53 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, with patchy fog in the morning and with rain and high temperatures 57 degrees.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
This is National Native News. I'm Jacqueline Estes, filling in for Antonia Gonzalez. No charges have been filed following six suspicious fires on the Lacouturay or LOC reservation more than 2 weeks ago. Wisconsin Public Radio's Mike Simonson reports.
The suspected arson cases, which targeted ceremonial and spiritual places, were called criminal in nature by tribal police. LCO Tribal Police Chief Tim DeBrot won't comment on the case, except to confirm a person remains in custody. The fires destroyed an historic Big Drum Hall ceremonial lodge, as well as attempted to burn a part of the Honor the Earth powwow grounds. Two sweat lodges were destroyed and a ceremonial dance ring was damaged. Paul Domain lost his living quarters in one of the fires. He says several church denominations are coming together to condemn what he says is persecution of traditional rituals.
It was attack on religious rights. It wasn't non-Indians. It was members of our own community attacking other members of the community. And to me, it's in a situation that's just out of balance.
The state fire marshal and Department of Justice are assisting in the investigation. None of the agencies involved are granting interviews since the case remains under investigation. The Lacouturay tribe was scheduled to meet Wednesday morning to deal with the suspected arson. For National Native News, I'm Mike Simonson.
About 100 people gathered last week to remember 400 from Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Michigan who died in an 1852 march. Wisconsin Public Radio's Jessica Hamilton reports from Sandy Lake, Minnesota.
In October in 1850, members of area Ojibwe tribes gathered at Sandy Lake for treaty annuity payments. What they didn't know was that it was a plan from government officials to force them from their reservation land. They waited until early December, but the payments were never fully dispersed. It began what would later be known as the Sandy Lake Death March. Great Lakes Indian Fish and Wildlife Commission Chairman Mick Isham of Lacouturay agrees it's important that this event is brought to light.
Even through all of that, we still survive today. And still stuff is happening. Just a week or two ago, we've had six of our sacred cultural sites burned on our reservation. And that stuff doesn't stop us in any way. It kind of makes you stronger.
Jessica Hamilton in Sandy Lake, Minnesota.
In the third of our series on climate change and Alaska Natives, Johanna Urich reports Natives facing the impacts of warming temperatures are looking to their elders for guidance.
Natives from Siberia shared work they did to protect walruses hauled out near their village when ice retreated. When the same thing happened on the Alaska side of the Chukchi Sea, Inuit in Point Lay were ready. They took actions to protect the tens of thousands of walruses hauling out near them, rerouting travel to reduce noise, preventing walruses from stampeding and killing each other. Working with state and federal officials, Point Lay rerouted barge traffic and also convinced the Federal Aviation Administration to put flight restrictions over the haul-out. Villagers have changed their own boating patterns to avoid disturbing the animals. Meanwhile, on St. Lawrence Island, the communities of Gamble and Savunga are working to reinstate an antique ordinance, setting their own catch limit and other protections for the island's marine mammals. Perry Pingawi.
We need to have something that's of our own, that was made by our elders in the past, that is working.
Many scientists are also now turning to natives for help in understanding the changes sweeping the world. I'm Johanna Urich.
On this date in 2011, the Suquamish Tribal Council in Washington voted to allow same-sex marriages on their reservation involving at least one tribal member, making them the second tribe after the 2008 decision of the Coquille Indian Tribe in Oregon to approve same-sex marriages. For National Native News, I'm Jacqueline Estes.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico, by Kawanic Broadcast Corporation. Funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, the Ford Foundation, and the Nathan Cummings Foundation.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Time is 3:06 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau here on a June afternoon. First guest is Ariel Rolfe here to talk about an interesting art display that's coming up in the capital city, Fecal Matters. Ariel, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thank you.
So tell me about the exhibit, please, if you could.
Sure. So I'm partnering with the Gatineau Humane Society to do an exhibit this first Friday from 4:30 to 6:30 in Pocket Park, which is just downtown on the corner of Franklin and Front Street. And the exhibit is about dog poop in our capital city and why it's a problem and what we can do to solve it.
What inspired you to put the display together?
I read an article by Jeff Kirsch in the Juneau Empire in May, and it was called Slack Tide, Dog Turds of Alaska, and you can look it up online. He's got a blog as well, but that inspired me because I didn't know anything about the toxins and bacteria that grow in dog poop, and so I thought it was interesting, and not very many people know about that, I don't think, and wanted to highlight that.
Is this a dog poop on trails, on the sidewalk, or where in particular?
Anywhere out in the open, basically. So we're going to focus on the dog poop on trails that aren't being cleaned up after.
Could you describe the project, what it's going to look like?
Sure. It's going to be six panels, and it's based off of an exhibit that you might see in a museum, for instance. So it'll be six panels, and all in black and white, designed by Christian Carrillo. And then they're also made to be left outside. So after the exhibit this Friday, we're going to put them out at the trailheads around town. And there's six panels. So
you're not going to have the actual item?
No, we won't, hopefully.
You have an interesting tagline?
Yeah, well, I'm a big fan of puns, and I thought that, there's a reason why I'm doing the exhibit, which is that it really does matter. There's a big problem with dog poop and all of the toxins that are that grow in it or are in it, and then bacteria that also can be transferred to humans or other dogs and things like that.
Can you talk a little bit more about the toxins?
Sure. So there's lots of bacteria by the process the digestive system goes through, getting a little graphic, I guess, but...
Turn your radio on, you'll be easily offended.
Okay. So after dogs eat, the enzymes in the stomach will, break down a lot of the chemicals and bacteria and whatever else that's being ingested. And what isn't broken down by those enzymes will be excreted by anyone, but dogs in particular in this particular case. And so those toxins will be left in the poop, and it can seep into the ground from that point. And one thing that I mention in the exhibit is that the EPA has classified dog poop on the same par and toxicity level as motor oil. So it'll give you an idea of how bad this really is for our environment.
Imagine you've seen it a lot more. It's opened your eyes a little bit more.
Yes, definitely. I know much more than I ever wanted to know about dog poop.
This is going to be happening starting this Friday at the Pocket Park.
Yeah, and it's just the one night only. And then it'll be up at the trailheads. But it'll one other thing, too, for this exhibit is that Stephanie DeRue will be there doing caricatures, so everybody can bring their pets and get a caricature from Stephanie.
Why did you choose this location for the exhibit?
I chose this location because it's right on the First Friday circuit, and then it's also a public space, and it's free to rent and free to come to, so it'll be a friendly and easy to get to venue.
All right, are poop bags going to be available?
Hopefully, yeah. The Gatineau Humane Society is doing the reception, so I haven't exactly asked them to.
All right, Ariel Ralph, thank you so much for coming down and talking about fecal matters.
Thank you.
Time is 3:12, and you are tuned in to KTOO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Our next guests are Alan Monroe and Christine Cooks, here to talk about Water States opening at Franklin Street Gallery this Friday. Christine and Alan, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Oh, it's always a pleasure, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff.
So could you describe the theme, please, Christine?
Yes, we have chosen Water States as a... unfortunately, perhaps a very appropriate theme for this summer. It came about at a painting retreat back in May, and we thought that glacier and some of the water images out there are always popular, and it evolved into all states of water, from frozen to steam to liquid. And we felt that there was going to be enough inspiration. We had no idea we'd be record-setting rain amounts this past summer. And we just sent out a request to local artists asking for any paintings they might have along this theme. And 15 artists stepped up. And so we're going to have a really exciting show with these different interpretations of water in all its states.
Alan, you're one of the artists. What is it? What's your medium?
Well, acrylics as a rule, but sometimes mixed media. Ink and, sometimes crayon, pastel, whatever.
What are you going to be having on display this Friday?
What am I going to display?
Mm-hmm, this Friday.
Well, if I'm lucky, I'll be able to hang a number of paintings, and they'll be in mostly acrylics on canvas and on Bristol board. And I guess I got one pencil, and I think there's some all pastel. Yeah.
What is the subject matter?
The subject matter... I do abstract stuff. I like to think that I'm probably an abstract expressionist, but I've gotten into mixing it up a little bit with conceptual art, which really doesn't pay that much attention to an object, or it's more ideas that are generated from a piece of work. And that I'm sort of mixing the two together, so there'll be some things in there that have that that flavor.
Are you thinking of rain?
About three pieces, three pieces have that flavor.
What were you thinking when you were doing the abstract expressionist work?
Well, you know, I love the idea Christine had with regard to, you know, a theme. Theme shows are fun because then you can let your mind work on that concept. And abstract expression really works well with themes because, you know, there's no limitation as to thing. I mean, you're not required to paint the rivers or oceans or whatever. You can let yourself go, and that's what I did.
But you can be inspired by rivers and oceans.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Especially when you're out in one on a boat. Inspiration is big, but you know what? You can be inspired right from your own mind, and that's where I've been getting it. That's where I've been getting it. Yeah.
Christine, you want to talk about the other artists involved?
Yes, we have a watercolor artist, Carol Baker. A lot of local Juneau people know her. She lives in Gustavus, and so she's one of the folks who responded. And all the rest of us are from Juneau. Nancy Roselle Brown, Barbara Craver, Jay Crondell.
Actually, before we go too much further, if you describe the medium and maybe give us a hint about what we can expect to see.
Yes, a lot of the images are going to be oil, acrylic, and pastel. The majority of them actually, well, I guess there's a range. There's smaller pieces, say 8 by 12, but then we have some very large canvases too. It really is a very mixed show, all flat work. This is all two-dimensional flat pieces that will be hanging on the walls. And, you know, it's funny because Alan started talking about being inspired by his mind, and that's what I saw was he sent in his titles. I've only seen one of his images so far, but it was having rose water. Can I say some of the titles?
Sure, say them all.
If I could remember, I don't know. Rose water, toilet water.
White water.
Salt water. You know, and all of a sudden when you say something like that, rainwater or rose water, you know, the different images that come to mind. So I'm really intrigued, and I think maybe the audiences will also be intrigued that what would they be thinking if they had submitted something from water?
Some of the things that, you know, that what I was thinking there, you were talking about, you know, how do you come up with these things? Well, they come out of my mind, but I'm also, it's a play on words, Jeff, you know? I mean, I like doing that. I'm a little bit of a raven when it comes to that. I like to play with ideas and make them backwards, if you will, and play off of themselves.
That's what art is.
Imagine with the toilet water piece, you didn't know you were going to be on the same show as the Fecal Matter.
Well, if I'd known that, we'd have spread a little toilet water around.
Well, that was my question. It was like, so are we talking eau de toilette, or where are we going with this? But, and that's, I think, the beauty of the show. We have large and small canvases. We have oil. We have acrylic. Lots of people took some whimsy. A lot of people also did very beautiful landscape, just sort of their interpretation of this misty place we live. Beautiful representational paintings and abstracts. So it's a full range. I think there'll be something in the show for everybody. I was especially pleased that some people who don't exhibit real regularly here stepped up. And so Marianne Slemons, Barbara Shepherd, Terry Robus, and Timmy Johnson, they all have pieces in the show. Michelle Morell, Sue Kraft, Jim Fowler, Jay Crondell. So there's people that we've had the opportunity to see some of their work before, but this is very themed and very specific to this show.
With the theme of rain, it sounds like it could be a very depressing show.
Oh, but, you know, these are artists, and I decided, hey, we're going bright. I did one called Stranded Bergs, which after that big flood out at the glacier, just these big, colorful icebergs stranded up on the side of the glacier. If people didn't have a chance to get out there and see that early in July, it was quite spectacular. So we've got every color in the rainbow. And, you know, water's reflective.
Yeah, I haven't seen, you know, what's there other than my own work, which, of course, I did. But the thing about it is that it's anything, as far as I'm concerned, anything but depressive.
No.
It's that's why I paint, so I don't get totally depressed.
So we really, and this is the 25th opening. So the Franklin Street Gallery, this is the 25th opening we've had. So actually we're going to have some, for the first 200 people, they'll get a kiss. That's what we're giving away, kisses. They'll get kisses.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah, the best kind, chocolate.
Can we start now? No.
It's all open to what time on Friday?
This will be 4:30 to 7. There is a wine tasting for a small fee. We're at the Baranoff Hotel just inside the door, the Franklin Street Gallery, and we hope everybody will enjoy it, rain or shine. Come on in, and we have a place to hang your coat and umbrella if it is raining, but maybe we'll get a beautiful day like this where it's just nice and misty clouds.
Yeah, well, you know, the only thing I would add is, you know, I think there's a lot of room for conceptual art in this town with as many issues as we've got going on right here with local government, whatever, in the state, in Juneau. Conceptual art makes a lot of sense. That's all I wanted to say. So artists, think conceptually.
I'm sure that's not all you wanted to say, but that's okay. Christine Cook and Alan Monroe. But Water States, the opening up of the Franklin Street Gallery this Friday, 15 artists interpret water. Thank you very much for coming down. Is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
No. Thank you very much, Jeff.
Thanks, Jeff. No, that's great. Nice interview.
Thank you for coming down.
Yep.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 1st of August, 2012. It's the birthday of the man who said it is better to fail in originality than to succeed in imitation, Herman Melville, New York City, 1819. His father died when Melville was 12, family left penniless. He tried working first in a bank, then as a teacher. When he was 26, he went to sea, and he ended up on a ship in the South Pacific, which he deserted. He went to live for several months with the Typee natives and wrote a book about it called Typees, A Peep into Polynesian Life. Came out in 1846. It was very successful. Melville married. He settled down in the Berkshires of Western Massachusetts, became a friend to Nathaniel Hawthorne, and set to work writing his great allegorical novels. Moby Dick came out in 1851, followed by Pierre and The Confidence Man. None of them were critical successes. And so Melville accepted a job as a customs inspector in New York, lived, worked quietly for the next 20 years. He was an honest customs inspector in a field at a time when there was a great deal of bribery around him. Died of a heart attack at the age of 72. His obituary in the New York Times was just 4 lines in length. It wasn't until the 20s when British critics discovered him that Melville was rediscovered and his works were put back in print. It's the birthday of the man who wrote the national anthem, Francis Scott Key, born in Carroll County, Maryland, 1779. Wrote that poem, which was entitled Defense of Fort McHenry. Also wrote a book on religion and literature, and he had a good career as a lawyer as well. It's the birthday of the poet who said, conscience is no more than the dead speaking to us. Jim Carroll, born in New York City, 1949, grew up on the Lower East Side, basketball player, talented student, author of the Basketball Diaries, which were published first in the Paris Review. His books of poems included Living at the Movies, which won a Pulitzer Prize, and he started a band, the Jim Carroll Band, in the 80s, which came out with 3 albums, including Catholic Boy. Here's a poem for today by Margaret Atwood, entitled A Boat. Evening comes on, and the hills thicken, red and yellow bleaching out of the leaves. The chill pines grow their shadows. Below them the water stills itself, a sunset shivering in it. One more going down to join the others. Now the lake expands and closes in both. The blackness that keeps itself under the surface in daytime emerges from it like mist or as mist. Distance vanishes. The absence of distance pushes against the eyes. There is no seeing the lake, only the outlines of the hills, which are almost identical, familiar to me as sleep, shores unfolding upon shores in their contours of slowed breathing. It is touch I go by, the boat like a hand feeling through shoals and among dead trees, over the boulders, lifting unseen layer on layer of drowned time, falling away. This is how I learned to steer through darkness by no stars. To be lost is only a failure of memory. A poem by Margaret Atwood, A Boat, from her selected poems, number 2, 1976 to 1986, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt and used by permission here on the Writer's Almanac. Supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, celebrating 100 years of discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Edited by Noah Smith. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Time is 3:27, and you are tuned to KTVO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Reminder that the U.S. Forest Service will begin hazardous tree removal along the Aqua Recreation Area Road tomorrow beginning at 9 in the morning. Users traveling through the area should expect delays for the duration of the work, which is expected to wrap up by 1 o'clock tomorrow. Again, that's on the Aqua Recreation Area Road. Pretty much a series of delays due to tree removal from tomorrow from 9 a.m. till 2 in the afternoon. In the studio with us now talking about trees is Darren Snyder from the U.S. Cooperative Extension Service. I'm here to talk about the 4-H Sustainable Harvest Camp. Darren, thank you very much for coming down to the station.
I'm glad to be here, Jeff. Thank you.
So before we get too much further, what is the Cooperative Extension Service?
Ah, okay, that's a big question. The Cooperative Extension Service is the land-grant university system throughout the United States, reaching out into communities, engaging with communities, and responding to community needs. And that's what the service is about.
And you're involved with the 4-H Club as well.
Yeah, so 4-H developed out of the Extension Service and out of the land-grant universities' efforts to work in communities and again, respond to needs. It originally started in the Midwest with farmers and their kids who are the kids were being taught about some of the new varieties that were coming out of the universities, and it ended up that the kids were wowing their parents and teaching them a thing or two about how to grow a better ear of corn or how to grow a bigger watermelon, and it was a way of actually engaging with the parents through the kids, and it kind of grew from there, and so now it's a much different creature the way we do it up here in Alaska.
And the 4-H Sustainable Harvest Summer Camp is happening August 13th through 17th. Could you describe the camp, please?
Yeah, the whole idea of Sustainable Harvest and the camp is that we are promoting educating kids and having a good time with the kids, teaching them how to, whether it be hunting, fishing, just wildcrafting, gathering plants, botanicals, gardening, all kinds of harvests, and how to do that ethically and successfully and have fun with it, and how to do it safely. We have a whole element of survival and how to be safe in the woods kind of aspects to this camp as well. So we're teaching them these basic skills all within a very kind of nurturing and positive camp experience.
What age kids are invited to attend?
Middle school through high school, so age about 11 on through 18, and it's a good size, good range of youth, and a total of we're keeping it kind of small these first couple of years. This is the second year we've done this residential camp, and so we have 20 kids, 20 slots, so we are developing these kids to be future leaders of the camp if they so choose to do so. So it's a growing and developing process. So that's why we're keeping it small as we teach the kids the basic concepts of sustainable harvest, but then also develop these youth to be the leaders of the camp into the future.
How do you grab hold of a major concept like sustainability?
That's a good question. Sustainability kind of means its own thing to each person, but generally, I think everybody can kind of appreciate that sustainability means to be able to continue with what we are doing, and in this case, having a successful, healthy harvest for generations to come. And so by teaching the youth the idea that we are here for this bit of time and that we have many relatively infinite generations to come behind us, that we're here to steward this these resources that we have properly, and there are ways of doing that, and so that's the idea of sustainability that we're trying to share.
Okay, the camp is happening August 13th through 17th. Could you describe what's going to be happening during the days?
We're still defining exactly every day's activities because we're going to respond to the age levels of kids who do come to the camp. And we have a number of experts from throughout the community, such as I'll just pick a few of them. Rich Mattson from the DIPAC Hatchery. He is going to be working with John Smith, who is an Indian Studies specialist and teacher in the school district. And those two, as they did last year, are going to teach the kids about some of the basics of salmon biology, salmon resources, the management of these resources within our systems within Southeast Alaska, and then also ways of preparing these fish by how to traditional ways of filleting and smoking and canning and processing all these fish and eventually eating them. So we're kind of looking at the whole ball of wax. We're looking at what these resources are in Southeast and how to use them. We also have Merrill Jensen, who's with the Jensen Olson Arboretum, the city's arboretum just past the shrine, and he is extremely generous with our group to let us go over there and to learn about what it takes to have a successful garden cultivated harvest here in Southeast Alaska, and then we get to give back by helping tend that garden, not only harvesting but also bringing in seaweed from the beaches to then bring back the nutrients to the garden and to have that cycling as part of the educational experience. And Merrill's a great partner with that. The list kind of goes on and on. The Department of Fish and Game, Kristen Romanoff, has been a great builder of this program over the past few years, and now she has moved on to a statewide responsibility. So now her new regional person is Tenny Bentz, and we're looking forward to working with her and her helping out with our camp through doing different fish and resource-related activities with the kids. And so it's going to be a fun camp, definitely full of kayaking and hiking and shelter building for survival purposes to learn how to build a safe and adequate shelter, how to make fires, navigation, a whole plethora of activities.
You haven't mentioned Tlingit potatoes yet.
No, I haven't, but we are crossing our fingers that the potatoes will be ready for harvest. I've got a call in to Merrill to see how those are developing. But the Tlingit potatoes, along with many other varieties of potatoes, do fortunately grow really well in our environment here. And so we're hoping to pick some of those and talk about some of the history around that and how those have been grown here for hundreds of years and are an excellent resource.
So you've been for about 20 campers. It's a residential camp, you say?
Yeah, so we're basing out of the lodge there with Saga, so they're another great partner in this. They have an excellent facility which can house 20 youth along with our staff. And as well, there's an excellent kind of a wet room underneath, kind of a glorified garage with sinks and everything else that we can do some of our dirty work, as it were, to process the fish and possibly a deer. We'll cross our fingers that we may even be able to get our hands on a deer or other mammals to process and to learn about harvesting those animals.
And the cost, and are there scholarships available?
Yeah, the cost is only $125, and the scholarships that are available, if people do need a scholarship, then they should contact our office, and we'll talk to them about options. One of the options that the city and borough and our taxpayers are so generous to offer is through the Department of Parks and Rec. Yeah, Parks and Rec, and they offer a $100 scholarship each fiscal year for qualifying Juneau residents. So a $100 scholarship is there for our youth to have to help offset the costs.
So let's say they're going to the camp and they're all prepared. What are they bringing with them?
Mostly just cold, wet weather gear, just like you'd need in any Juneau summer. And that'll include your rain boots and rain gear and polypropylene and those things. We'll definitely give kids a list. I would suspect, I know that bug dope is on that list as well. And hopefully the need for suntan lotion will come in too. So we'll put that to the list too. We'll see how that goes. But otherwise, sleeping bags, the current plan is to be sleeping in the lodge, but we also have the option to tent out for some of the days too if we want to do that out on the beach if it turns out to be a really nice nice weather for that.
How do people register?
The best way to register is to call our office at 796-6221 and talk to Dora, and she will help line you up with all the registration forms. You can also find us online if you just Google Juneau, Alaska 4-H, and then once you get onto our site there, you can find the camp flyer with more information.
And I've been talking to Darren Snyder from the Cooperative Extension Service about the 4-H Sustainable Harvest Summer Camp happening August 13th through 17th. Darren, is there anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
I just encourage you to think about youth who are in your lives who are interested in outdoor activities and available that week of August 13th, and to give our office a call at 796-6221, and they'll have a week of great fun.
Thanks for coming by, Darren.
I'm sorry?
Thanks for coming by.
Thank you so much, Jeff. Take care.
If I were an apple, I'd be very unhappy traveling 4,000 miles or more. From far off Tasmania in a shipping container to a shelf in a New Jersey store. Why should I be tortured when some New Jersey orchard would be totally thrilled to the core? To pick me and crate me and load me and freight me, not 4,000 miles but 4. An apple should be not far from the tree where it ripens in the fall. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. If I were a berry, I expect I'd be very contrary and hardly inclined to get shipped out from Chile to a store in North Philly. Hey, I'd have to be out of my mind. It seems paradoxic in carbon dioxic that we force all our food to commute, wasting gallons of fuel, which we know isn't cool for people or planets or fruit.
A berry is fine, not far from its vine, near the farmer's market stall. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. Might want to take home. Do not buy for your table till you check out the label and determine how far it's in Rome. Aside from the karma of helping the farmer who lives in your county or state, there is one more good reason to buy what's in season. The taste is incredibly great. So keep buying foods from regional dudes. Keep your carbon footprint small. Locally grown and locally eaten is globally good, good, good for us all. Good, good, good for us all.
Tom Chapin from his CD, Give Peas a Chance. Time is 3:42 and you are tuned to KTUO News in Juneau here on a Juneau afternoon. Next guests are Dana White and also James Marcus here to talk about the Invasive Plants Workshop, which is going on tomorrow night. In particular, it's about knotweed. They're from the Alaska Association of Conservation Districts. Dana and James, thank you very much for coming down to the station today.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks a lot, Jeff.
First of all, you have to tell me what the Alaska Association of Conservation District is.
It's a nonprofit based out of Wasilla that deals with soil and water conservation.
Yeah. We staff the soil and water conservation districts around the state, so we are involved in various aspects, including invasive plant management, which is why Dana and I are here.
You need to define an invasive plant, please.
So invasive plants, the legal definition means that they're a plant that causes some sort of harm to either the ecology, the economy, or to human health. So by definition, usually most plants that we bring into our environment can't really survive in this type of ecology, whereas maybe 10% of those could actually survive and escape cultivation, per se, so if you grew them in a garden or whatnot. And out of that 10%, we got a really small fraction that has the potential of wiping out diversity by just taking over everything involved. And so those are the ones that we're considering invasives. And unfortunately, invasive knotweeds are one of the highest priority species because they're so aggressive.
How do you deal with them?
Well, we're going to have a workshop tomorrow afternoon, or tomorrow evening, rather, from 6 to 8 at the downtown library, and we're going to talk about all the different methods. It's not easy. It's one of those plants that if you cut it, chop it, or dig it, it actually spreads. So there's alternatives, and we are working on Adopt a Knotweed Stand program. So if people want to get together and use each other as community support to deal with this thug, we have potential for that.
You call them thugs?
Thugs of invasive thugs, for sure,
invasive
this one is.
Thugs. Yeah, it's a very tenacious plant that like Dana says, it just does not stop. And you can chop it, dig it, but it's only going to spread. That kind of gets it started. So we've got a few different methods that we've worked through. And it's really interesting learning about all the different ways that you can control them. And some methods are more effective than others. So we're going to present those. And this is totally, like Dana said, a volunteer and community effort where we're trying to get everyone here involved. If you see it in your neighborhood, we would love to, for you to just even notify us and let us know.
How did it get here in the first place?
So it's always a mysterious question. How did it get here? But the first question is probably as an ornamental garden species because and it was brought in, and it grows so well, and people thought of it as a hedge, and they would even call it like bamboo or Japanese bamboo, but it's in the buckwheat family, so it's actually a grass. But this guy, it's home to Japan, one of the types of knotweeds, and it means, it translates as strong plant. So we're looking at a plant that's evolved in an ecosystem where we get volcanic action that breaks down and pushes it around. So the way knotweed works is it has roots or underground rhizomes that go 20 feet from each stalk, and all you need is half an inch of that root or rhizome to start a whole new plant. And so that's where a lot of people are confused, and we're trying to work on some work together on this.
I'm very curious. Could you give me an example of some of the eradication techniques?
Well, there are four major categories of management methods that we use in the invasive plant world. The mechanical method, which is oftentimes pulling, digging, using weed whackers or mowing, those sorts of things. There are chemical methods in which herbicides are employed, using different techniques. There is biocontrol, in which people are introducing natural controls, for example, plants and insects that can better control those. And what's the fourth one, Data?
Cultural.
Yes. And that's more in line of an agricultural, but also...
It's outreach and education, too. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people learn what is better to do and maybe to plant in your garden, like we often take care of that on our own as a community. So,
what do they call them knotweeds for? It strikes up a very strong image of it strangling the other plants.
Well, it has nodules in between on the stalk, so it looks a little bit like bamboo stalks. And so any knotweed has that characteristic. And there's all sorts of different ones out there, even little weeds that have that little connecting elbow or whatnot. But there are four different types of knotweed. We have Japanese Himalayan, giant, and then what typically is in Juneau is Bohemian, which is a hybrid between the Japanese and a giant.
And there's a workshop going on tomorrow night at 6 p.m. at the downtown library?
Yes, it is.
What's going to happen during the workshop?
During the workshop, we're going to team up with people who have knotweed and want to figure out how to deal with it best and see if we can have people sign up to adopt stands. And then in the meantime, we'll be setting up volunteers to help support each other in these efforts. And then we'll be teaching proper techniques. And one of the things that is an effective method is injection with a water-safe herbicide. So if people are interested in this method or learning about it, this is one place. But if it's a small stand, like manual control isn't totally out of the question. We're just every site has to be determined specifically on what kind of treatment it's going to be.
What other invasive plants are there in Juneau?
That's a really long list, but I guess some of the top ones would be orange hawkweed, which we're all seeing blooming right now, that bright little orange flower. Oxeye daisy, the white daisy that is all alongside the road, and both of those are spreading dramatically out the road. And
we also have a perennial south thistle in a few areas. Reed canary grass is a big one. Likes to colonize and water kind of shoreline areas and stream sides, and that can be extremely detrimental to salmon spawning streams. So those are a few on our high priority. If you're interested in learning more, you can check out our website, junoinvasives.org.
What about the people who say, oh, they're so cute?
This is true.
They do. The orange hawkweed, like Dana was mentioning, has a very pretty orange flower. Unfortunately, it will sooner than later, it will probably take over if left unchecked, and all you'll see is orange flowers. And it reduces the biodiversity by extreme measures and creates a single-strand monoculture. So, it's all about educating the public and coming up with ideas and working with alternatives to find other suitable plants to revegetate.
Are you going to work parties to see if they work on eradication methods?
Absolutely, mm-hmm. Yes. And knotweed in particular, as well as reed canary grass, have a serious threat to our salmon streams. And that's one of the main reasons we're looking at this, is because we see in Oregon and Washington and even British Columbia where it's taken over the river's edges. And what we say reduces biodiversity, we're reducing the diversity of the plants, the diversity of the animals, the diversity of the insects that then fall into the rivers that create the food source. So it's a big cyclical system. And even some of these plants even bring in diseases and cause issues with the soil so that nothing else can live around them.
You'll need more information on that website again, James?
It's junoinvasive.org, or you can email us at invasive.plants@gmail.com.
Dot JNU.
state.jnu@gmail.com, or you can call us at
907-586-6878.
Dina White and James Marcus, thank you for coming down and talking about the Invasive Plants Workshop, which is going on tomorrow at 6 p.m. at the Downtown Library.
Hope to see you there.
Anything you'd like to add I might have forgotten to ask?
Anybody who has knotweed, regardless if you want to deal with it or not, this would be a great place just to check out what's going on in your community and make some friends. Mm-hmm. Hope to see you.
Thank you. On Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, we don't ask the usual questions of our celebrity guests, and we don't get the usual answers. Here's legendary anchorman Tom Brokaw making a startling admission.
You can tell where my inclinations are. I'll take nipples over body odor any day.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that practically guarantees too much information. Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me from NPR.
Saturday mornings at 11 o'clock on KTO News.
Spirit of Youth celebrates teenage Alaskans who are making our communities better places to live.
They give their time, their hearts and minds, their passion, their creativity. Now, hear their stories.
Christopher Marks is 16 years old and lives in Dillingham, and he spends a lot of his time in the public library in town. Now, there are a bunch of reasons why a high schooler might spend time in the library, but this student is there because he's needed. Christopher is a regular volunteer whose specialty is technology.
Before, I was just fixing computers and having them run, and then we got a grant with the OWL project online with libraries, and so we're getting broadband and some new computers and a video conferencing system. So I set up the computers and worked with the internet and all that stuff.
Christopher says his dad taught him a lot about computers. Plus, he's already had some college-level instruction, too.
Probably about 7 or 8 years old, I was working with computers a lot. Started working with them a lot.
What do you like about them?
The hardware, mostly, and a couple programs. I like working with my hands.
Jim Jones works for the University of Alaska in Dillingham and has been helping with the library's recent technological upgrades. He says Christopher has a great aptitude and attitude and helped out all over the place, from making cables to connecting servers.
Christopher, over the years, showed an interest. You know, he'd come over and ask, how can I do X, Y, or Z? And we would explain to him how you can do it. He'd go back there and do it. And he did a lot of that work, and you know, because he's learned how to do that, and we've trained him over the years.
I'm Shanna Sheehy.
Give a young person you know a boost by recognizing the good things they're doing. Nominate at spiritofyouth.org. Brought to you by the Division of Behavioral Health at the Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
Time is 3:58 and you are tuned to KTOO News in Juneau. We broadcast at 104.3 FM in downtown Juneau and Douglas. KTOO also broadcasts on these translators. In the Valley and Ocpe area, tuned to K276 AF at 103.1. In Lemon and Schweitzer Creek, K269 AO at 101.7. Gustavus listens on K201 AM 88.1. K220 BT Sirsuna at 91.9. In Excursion Inlet and Icy Strait, you can hear KTOO on K210 AS 89.9. Also live online at www.ktuo.org. Tomorrow at 3 o'clock on a Juneau afternoon, we'll talk with Fumi Matsumoto about her art show opening Friday at the campus. Kay Connie from the Juneau Family Health and Birthing Center will be here to highlight their pregnancy class. We'll learn about the Jump Film Festival going on this weekend, and Nancy Nacherny will give us a rundown on art happenings in the capital city during Arts Up. At Writer's Almanac Music and more tomorrow at 3 on a Juneau afternoon. The forecast for tonight, mostly cloudy skies with patchy fog later on, a chance of rain later on, low temperatures to 47 to 53 degrees. Forecast for Thursday, patchy fog in the morning with rain, high temperatures around 56 degrees. Friday looks like rain is likely with high temperatures around 57 degrees. Saturday through Monday, partly cloudy skies with high temperatures around 63 degrees. Thank you for tuning in to Juneau Afternoon today. If you'd like to be on a Juneau Afternoon or know someone that should be, please give me a call. My name is Jeff Brown. My phone number is 463-6425. Coming up next is All Things Considered.
went abroad to learn a lot, to listen a lot, to get briefings on some complicated issues. And I think in that sense, the trip was a remarkable success.
Mitt Romney's foreign policy advisor assesses the candidate's trip abroad. It's